I'm ready. Let's do it. Right now, right here. Come on.
Right. Same as last time, remember? Your crowd control. I handle employees.
Mm-hmm. I love you, pumpkin.
I love you, honey bunny.
Everybody be cool, this is a robbery!
Any of you fucking pricks move! And I'll execute every motherfucking last one of you!
Hello, folks, and thank you for tuning in to the latest episode of Pop Culture Rewind. I'm your special guest host for this episode, Xavier. I forgot to say my name. Obviously, you can tell I'm new at this. But thankfully, with me here, as always, is the man behind Pop Culture Rewind, National Treasure. You know him, you love him, my very dear friend, Travis. Travis.
Oh, well, thank you for that wonderful introduction.
You like that?
This is going to be an interesting episode. Yeah. But, you know, it's funny. Earlier today, I just got done recording a huge year-in-review episode for the other podcast that I do, Houston Racing Radio. And
where will we find that?
HoustonRacingRadio.com.
Oh, that works. So
go check out the new year in review episode for you wrestling fans out there. But the reason I'm saying that is because I'm a little tired right now. And I'm going to have Xavier.
Let me QB this thing.
Yeah, there you go. Hey.
Yeah, that'll probably be the first and only sports reference I ever
Thank
make.
God, because I will not be able to follow this.
Wait, so wrestling's not a sport?
It's Ooh. athletic competition.
Hoisted by our own petard. Okay. Well, this episode could potentially run a little bit long, and I was very pleased to take the reins on this one because it's a topic I'm very passionate about. We've done a couple spotlight episodes in the past, so we decided to do another spotlight episode on a filmmaker I very much enjoy and respect and have followed very intently over the last 20 some odd years of his career, Quentin Tarantino.
Aha, yes.
Everybody knows this guy. Love him or hate him, everybody seems to have an opinion on this guy. But love him or hate him, there's no denying the influence he's had on films in his career.
Mm-hmm.
In a very short, I mean, a little over 20 years, but he's made like a lot of asterisks when you consider his career. Some movies he's written, some movies he's directed, some he's considered. Those are both one movie.
There's been some short films, things like that too. So,
yeah.
So all kinds of stuff. But, you can at least say he's been, like you said, over the last 20 some odd years, just relevant. You know, he's never really gone away. And he produces top quality products, you know. Quality over quantity, you know.
Yeah, so, totally. For like dollar for dollar, he's one of the most consistent directors I know. By which I mean, if a new Quentin Tarantino movie's coming out, I don't gotta know who's starring it. I don't gotta know what it's about. I'm gonna see it, and I know I'll bet dollars to donuts, I'm probably gonna like it. You know, he's the most consistent. Yeah. But I mean, totally, like on average, his, like if I was to give them all scores, more than almost any other director I can think of, you know, because I love so many of his movies, like, and mm-hmm. I mean, love his movies. The only other director I think might top him just from like grade wise might be Wes Anderson. that guy's consistent. I love everything he does. I celebrate his whole catalog. I'm a Wes Anderson fan. I love Michael Bolton too. No, but yeah, Quentin.
I knew it.
Yeah, you knew where I was going with that. But yeah, Quentin. Ever since I was a kid, really, in high school.
Yeah.
You know, before Tarantino-esque became a thing.
Yeah.
And that's the thing. His last name has been turned into an adjective, like Dickensian or something like that, like Tarantino-esque. Yeah, he's has spawned a legion of imitators. Mm-hmm. We could keep talking about how great he is, but let's actually talk about the movies he's done.
It's because of you back in our high school days, actually before high school, actually, maybe before high school, but you're the one that kind of turned me on to Quentin Tarantino's movies.
I think it was high school, because I'm thinking Pulp Fiction was
94, 95.
Yeah, somewhere around there. Might have been like freshman, eighth grade, something like that. But yeah, whatever.
Yeah, you had the Reservoir Dogs poster. Yeah. Yeah.
Which I still have. I actually threw that away like this year.
You sent me the picture of it.
Yeah. And then I sent you a picture of you sitting in front of it in high school.
Yeah.
Spraying whatever. You had a nice haircut. It was the 90s. I won't hit you on it.
Thank you.
Yeah. Yeah, and I'm really excited to get a chance to host a Quentin episode, because you know I really love Quentin just so much that, you know, hold on a second, let me just take my wallet out before I sit down and get comfortable here. There we go. Yeah, that's just wanted to take my wallet out and
That was, you know, I just, you know, that's an interesting wallet you just have there. I mean,
yeah, you like it?
Yeah. What's it say on there?
It says bad motherfucker.
Oh.
Yes, I have a bad motherfucker wallet. And it came with a Jules Winfield's, Sam Jackson's ID, like his driver's license, which I keep in the wallet. It was just thrown in as a joke when you bought it, but I keep it in there. Like, it's easier to see that ID than it is my actual ID. I think it just makes it a fun little thing. But yeah, dude, I mean, the bad motherfucker wallet.
Yeah.
That's awesome. I mean, in the movie, because I remember thinking, you know, when he says that, you know, is, you know, give him a wallet. Which one is it? It's the one that says bad motherfucker. And you're like, oh, Jules, you're just a funny guy. And he reaches in and his wallet really says bad motherfucker on it. Great gag. But we'll
Have you gotten any responses from that? Have you like shown it to other people or anything? Or
yeah, you know, if I'm at, you know, the grocery store and I need to, I kind of like very, you know, I make sure it's right side up and facing them or whatever. And yeah, I'm a little like, check out my wallet. Surprisingly, not a lot of people get it.
Yeah,
I think there's times people notice it and then they just don't say anything. And I'm like, you lame-o.
This has got a bad word on it.
Dirty word. He said a dirty word. I think they see it and they don't get the reference. And I'm like, you know, lame. Get out of my yard, lame-o. Hey, get out of my yard. Yeah. Forget them. I don't want your approval anyway. Yeah, but we're jumping again. We're talking about that wallet. Maybe I'll probably forget to touch on it later. But yeah, Quentin Jerome Tarantino. It's funny his middle name is Jerome, because I sometimes think he wishes he was black. But yeah, he was born in Tennessee, moved out to LA, big. Anybody who knows anything about him knows he's one of the hugest movies. He probably puts me to shame, man. He knows movies I've never even heard of. But yeah, he got a job. Most people know this story of working at a video store, Archives, where like there are people who years later will say, I remember going to that store and I remember Quentin working there. And he was this crazy movie savant and all that. And and he wanted to make movies. And he wrote a script called True Romance.
Right.
Which he tried to get made unsuccessfully for years. Tried to sell it for like 5 years, couldn't get it made. And so he gave up on that. He wrote a script called Natural Born Killers. Tried to get that made, still no hope. And then he started writing, I think around the same time he was writing Reservoir Dogs, he managed to finally sell True Romance.
Oh, okay, yeah.
So he had a little money in his pocket. I think he got like 50 grand for it. So he wrote Reservoir Dogs knowing that he's going to have money. Like, I can make this movie. I can, you know, film it for cheap, set it for cheap. If you look at Reservoir Dogs, it's you know, it's kind of like a bottle episode. It's mostly in the warehouse or a diner. Not a lot of, yeah. So he was planning to make it really cheap. So he's got these three scripts. He's finally got his foot in the door in Hollywood. And the studio who he had sold True Romance to, like the Hell Development, knew Tony Scott. And she kind of introduced Quentin to Tony Scott. And Tony read Reservoir Dogs and was like, this is a great script. I want to do it. That's probably a bad Tony Scott. But Quentin's like, no. No, Tony Scott. I want to do this movie. But I got a couple other scripts. If you want to check them out, you want to read those, maybe you want to do those. That's got to be so cool to have nothing and then tell Tony Scott, no, you can't direct my script. I'm doing it. Put balls on this kid, man. But that's right? Fucking cool. That's pimp. Yeah.
So was he still, and he was still working in the video store at this point, right?
I don't think he was working. I don't know if he still was. I think since he had sold the script and he was working for the studio for this, it's kind of a low budget studio. I think since he had money in his pocket and they were also hiring him to like polish dialogue and stuff. So he was actually working in the movies, in the movie industry. I don't know if he was still working at Video Archives anymore, but, yeah. So he gives Tony True Romance and Natural Born Killers, and Tony decides he wants to do, True Romance.
Yeah.
So I guess in a way, from a writer's point of view, a writer's journey as he's growing and evolving, you can consider True Romance, even though he didn't direct it, his first movie. Although Reservoir Dogs technically came out first, because that was such an easy movie to make. He filmed it really quick.
Yeah.
Got it out there. But True Romance was, I guess we'll just talk about True Romance really quick, since we just spent all this time talking about it. God, this. As much as I loved Quentin as a director, I don't know if I'd like. I can't imagine this movie any other way. It's perfect. It's an untouchable film, dude. It's perfect, dude. It's a perfect movie. And plus, I don't think Quentin could have attracted the talent that Tony Scott did to this movie. I mean, what a freaking cast
in
this movie. Like, little roles were given to, like, Samuel L. Jackson and Brad Pitt and stuff. And then Dennis Hopper, Christopher Walken, Christian Slater, Patricia Arquette. Val Kilmer, just everybody's in this freaking movie and they're all brilliant. This movie is firing on all cylinders. It's so good. If you haven't seen this movie, A, what the fuck is wrong with you? B, to sum it up, this is the IMDb summary. Clarence marries Hooker, Alabama, steals cocaine from her pimp, and tries to sell it in Hollywood while the owners of the coke try to reclaim it. And that's fair. I guess that's what it's about. But that just does it such a disservice. There's so much more going on in this movie, you know?
Yeah.
And Gary Oldman. We forgot to say Gary Oldman.
I was going to say Gary Oldman as Drexel.
Drexel Spivey.
Yeah.
Well, I think he's black.
We're both big Gary Oldman fans. But for me, seeing him in this role is just, it's just awesome.
This is one of his best roles. Gary Oldman has some great roles.
Yeah, yeah.
He looks creepy. He's a white guy with these dreads. He's got the white eye with the scar in his eye, talking like he's black. He even tells Clarence, like, you must have thought it was white boy day. And like, he totally thinks he's black. But I remember when I first saw this movie, I think my older brother rented it. And I didn't know anything about Quentin Tarantino. I watched like the first 10, 15 minutes and like fell asleep. Mm-hmm. And then the next day I tried to watch it again and I got bored. And then like the third time I finally managed to power through that opening.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not saying it's a slow opening. If you know the movie, it's a wonderful opening, you know, but it's the romance part of the film, if you will.
Yeah. Yeah.
But once the cocaine and all that other stuff gets rolling, it becomes like an awesome movie. Not to say like it has to be violent to be awesome. But apparently I consider this one of all the movies that he hasn't directed that he's written more his, is because the script is almost beat for beat. Well, word for word, his, it wasn't altered that much, but beat for beat is completely different. The script that he wrote, surprise, surprise, is written very much out of order. When Tony got a hold of it, yeah. When Tony got a hold of it, I guess Tony is like, I'm not dealing with this shit. Write it in order, and I'm gonna film it that way, and that's how the movie's gonna be. The movie jumps around a lot. It opens with him like, I'd fuck Elvis, and then it jumps into Drexel killing him for the coke, and then it jumps into Clarence going to visit Dennis Hopper.
Mm-hmm.
So we don't know exactly how Clarence got the coke. Mm-hmm. So it's like, what's going on? Did Clarence really kill these guys? Is he really the way Christopher Walken described him? He just came in blazing and with his whole girlfriend and, you know, oh, Christopher Walken and Dennis Hopper.
Of that scene? Are you talking about the scene, the interrogation scene?
No, I just thought like, hey, they're both in the movie. And like, yes, I'm talking about the Sicilian scene.
Oh, God.
It's just magic. It's magic on screen, dude. This should be taught in film classes or acting classes. It probably is. Or screenwriting classes. Or any class that has to do with making movies.
Dude, Christopher Walken is, like, seriously, like, legit scary in this scene.
Yeah.
Man, talk about intimidation. Holy shit.
And, like as he's pulling the scarf off and he's walking around, mm-hmm. like, he's not saying anything mean. He's almost being polite.
Yeah, but you know, yeah. some shit's about to go down. Like, ugh, yeah,
yeah. And he's got that whole speech about how he's Sicilian, and Sicilians are the great liars, best in the world, and mm-hmm. and how he can spot a liar because when a guy lies, the guy's got 17 pantomimes. Woman's got 20. Guy's got 17. and so he wants Dennis Hopper to give up where his son is, where his son's whereabouts are. And Dennis Hopper, and there's no lines. It's all in his expression and it's all silent, but you can tell the moment when he's like, I'm not getting out of this alive.
Yeah.
I'm not going to give my son up. So I guess this is it, you know, since I might be knocking on death's door soon, he asks him for a cigarette.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't smoke, but Dennis Hopper makes that cigarette look good because it's his last one and he knows it. He's like, he savors it in the scene. He's like, there's smoke all around him and
mm-hmm.
how it's everything on that scene is brilliant. And then he jumps into the famous Sicilians and you know what? If you know the scene, you know it's great. If you don't, watch the movie because it's brilliant to watch it unfold.
It's mesmerizing. This whole scene. Yeah,
totally. Because he fucks with Christopher Walken. And Christopher Walken is going to carry that in the back of his mind to the day he dies.
Yeah.
He's never going to be able to forget what this guy just told him. And he kills him, but he's like, yeah, I killed you, but fuck. I cannot not know what this guy just told me about something I take such pride in, which is being Sicilian. It's just great. It's brilliant. The whole fucking movie. Val Kilmer is Elvis, even though you never see his face. Yeah. But he's doing like a spot on Elvis. Spot on, spot on. yeah, this may even be his best script. I don't know.
It's solid for sure.
Totally solid. You know,
Patricia Arquette, she plays Alabama. Not to jump ahead or anything, but is that the same reference to a girl named Alabama in Pulp Fiction?
You mean in Reservoir Dogs?
Mr. Oh, yes. Where he says...
I believe it is. It's a good point. We mentioned a while ago when we did a Kevin Smith spotlight that he was sort of doing the shared universe back in the day too. Quentin, a lot more subtle, but his movies are kind of in the same universe as well.
Yeah, that's good. That's a good way of putting it. It's more subtle. It's not in your face. If you pay attention, you'll see some connections.
Yes,
but it's
and that's what made it gratifying because like I did pay attention. I felt like I was in on the secret. Again, this was before internet. I'm the one noticing. Like, hey, wait a minute, those names are the same and. Apparently, and this is, like I said, the script was for the most part faithful, except for one big change, which was the ending.
Mm-hmm.
In Tarantino's original script, Clarence, spoiler alert, well, in the original, Clarence dies.
Go ahead. I'm sorry. Yeah.
Yeah. So Alabama, you know, he dies. So she kind of leaves and becomes a badass thief, we're guessing. So when they mention her Reservoir Dogs, he's mentioning he worked with a thief named Alabama.
Mm-hmm.
So that sort of keeps with that continuity as opposed to what Tony Scott decided. I guess spoiler alert to change the ending. And I do like Tony's ending because he told Quentin, I'm going to film both endings just to shut you up and whichever one I like better. So I think if you go to YouTube, just type True Romance alternate ending. You could see the actual ending that Quentin wrote. And the directing's a little lazy. I think it's probably because Tony was like, I'm not fucking using this. He probably had an AD do it or something. I'm just doing this to shut that kid up.
I think on that, as far as the ending goes, I think I read somewhere that depending on when it's aired, like on TV or whatever like that, if it's on syndication or whatever, sometimes they'll they'll mix up the ending. It won't always be the same.
Oh, really? I've actually never seen this movie on TV.
Yeah. But I can't confirm that. This is, you know, internet, so it's got to be true, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I try. I mean, I read a lot of facts about him on the internet, but I tried to. I don't know. Can you trust some of these, you know, trivia facts that you read on Wiki and IMDb? I mean, anybody can edit these things. That's the thing.
Yeah, that's the bad thing about that.
Yeah. So if we say to take whatever we're saying with a grain of salt, because you know,
we don't know what the hell we're doing. Yeah.
Yeah, we're just idiots with a microphone.
Yeah.
But yeah, True Romance came out in 1993. Didn't do a lot of money right away, but has since gone on to become a big cult hit.
Two more things I just wanted to point out. That one fight scene between James Gandolfini and Patricia Arquette.
Oh, that's hard to watch, but yeah.
Yeah, that's brutal right there, man. Ooh. But that's, again, just going along with the tone of the film, man. Going, you know, there's that interrogation scene that's more mentally hard to get.
Gandolfini,
you know,
is great, too.
Do what?
Gandolfini is so good in that scene. This pre-Sopranos, oh, yeah, and all that. He is great. He's beating her. She's lying on the floor bloody, and he's sitting there smoking a cigarette, just talking about what it's like to kill mm-hmm. people. He's like, the first one's the hardest. And, you know, the second one, it's better. And he, you know. Oh, God. Yeah. Harsh scene. The director's cut of that scene is even harsher.
Oh, really? Oh, I haven't seen the director's cut.
So. Yeah. He beats her up a lot more.
Oh, yeah.
Quentin said that was like the big problem with the MPAA or whatever, was that scene. Because after, you know, she turns the tables on him and she stabs him and then shoots him once. But in the director's cut that I watched the other day, and I totally forgot about it because I was so familiar with my VHS copy, she blows him away with a shotgun and like,
oh, really?
Click, yeah. Click. Like she's into, and then she just starts beating his corpse with the shotgun. And then she's holding it in the air going like, ah! Like a berserker barbarian or something. It's yeah. And she's bloody as hell, and it's scary to look at. Yeah. And one other change that they did, I don't know if it was in the script, but when Tom Sizemore and Chris Penn are also in it, and they're also great, and Bronson Pinchot. When Chris Penn, you know what? Watch the director's cut. Chris Penn dies in a totally different way. I won't even spoil that one.
Okay, all right, fair enough. Yeah,
but it's fucking trippy, and it changes how he dies. Well, I guess I just spoiled that he dies, but whatever. You know, if you haven't watched it yet, yeah, I don't even care. I don't care what you.
You just mentioned Bronson Pinchot in this movie. He's pretty funny as Elliot. but it's weird. Usually, I'm used to seeing him playing a character with some kind of weird funny accent. He doesn't have a weird, funny accent in this movie.
He actually talks like a person.
But he's got a funny scene when he gets pulled over.
While he's getting the roadhead.
Yeah. And then the whole, the cocaine and everything. It's a really funny scene. This is a good, solid movie. I mean, all these are really good, solid movies, but.
Mm-hmm. Some more than others, but this is up there, man. This might be my favorite Tony Scott movie. And I think Tony Scott's a great director. I said a few episodes back, Ridley Scott like just doesn't do anything for me. Tony. Mm-hmm. Tony, on the other hand, I thoroughly enjoy his movies. Yeah.
May you rest in peace.
Yes. All right.
Now, one thing that is in this movie that is I kind of want to say a signature of Tarantino, and correct me if I'm wrong, but it starts off with just kind of a big dialogue heavy opening scene. Like him in the bar, just kind of talking about, he's talking fucking about Elvis, right? Yeah. And fuck Elvis. A lot of, especially in his earlier movies, I mean, that was a kind of the thing that you would see, right? And just like the start of all his movies, just like some kind of big scene.
Yeah, Reservoir Dogs started in the diner. Pulp Fiction starts in a diner.
But it's always about something. It almost feels like it was added in later, like because sometimes it doesn't have anything to do with the movie. I'm thinking more or less with Reservoir Dogs. Which we can go and talk about that one right now if you want. That's kind of the next one
I was saying, he decided he wanted to make Reservoir Dogs. He ended up getting more funding for it than beyond the 50 grand, whatever. Yeah. But which is a good thing. So, he made Reservoir Dogs really quick and got that out just before True Romance. But Reservoir Dogs is Quentin's first directorial debut theatrically. He made like a whole movie that never got released. I can't seem to find it. It's called like My Friend's Birthday or something. Yeah, Reservoir Dogs. This was an obscure one in the 90s. Not a lot of people. Now everybody seems to know it.
Mm-hmm.
But I remember it was. I remember this movie was so obscure when I was in high school. I was in like a creative writing class or something, and our job was to like write a short story. And I think I had other homework to do, or just I was being lazy, whatever. I forgot, but I basically just plagiarized Reservoir Dogs and turned it into a short story, and turned it into my teacher, who was like an old lady, who I knew had never heard of Reservoir Dogs, but had never seen it. So I was like, "Fuck it, I'm just gonna." I mean, I didn't do the whole movie. Obviously, I basically took like a chunk,
right,
and turned it into a scene. I think my story ended with the revelation that the guy shot was the cop, and then it kind of ended. I don't spoiler even remember alert. If I could. Yeah, okay. Oh, yeah, you know what? Fuck it. Spoiler alert. We're going to be spoiling all of his movies.
Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, that's how like obscure the movie was. And I think I said the same thing about Clerks, was this was a movie that in the mid 90s was like, you know, Reservoir Dogs? Dude, you know Reservoir Dogs? Like, dude, mm-hmm. I know. Of course I know Reservoir Dogs. It was like that kind of a movie.
Yeah.
That you were cool if you knew about it, because it was very small. I don't remember it ever hitting the theaters.
Well, I clearly don't, because I watched it from you. So.
Yeah, I think I rented True Lies, and I, you know, you rent it, put two VCRs in, you record it, and there would always be trailers before the movie.
Right.
And I saw a trailer for Reservoir Dogs. I had never heard of this movie, but it looked awesome.
Mm-hmm.
So I dubbed it with True Lies onto my VHS copy. So every time I'd watch True Lies, I'd watch the trailer for this movie, that because I couldn't get a hold of it.
Yeah.
But I just thought it looked really, really intriguing. I don't even think I knew that Pulp Fiction and Reservoir Dogs were the same guy. It just looked like that movie looks interesting. So I recorded it, like a post-it note. Go look into this movie. But yeah, it's, you know, small budget. You could tell all the action happens off screen,
mm-hmm.
which is really clever.
Oh,
but
yeah.
Yeah, but you still feel like you know all about it.
and if you're, you know, I guess wanting to know some tips and tricks about directing, or if you're looking to get it, I mean, watch this movie and you'll see some good ways of doing some shortcuts, things like that. Like you're just saying that you never saw any of what was going on with like the heist or anything like that. It was all off camera.
Yeah.
So,
you didn't feel the lack of it.
Exactly. Yeah. You can tell it's always there.
Yeah.
But, even with the, where he's got the cop tied up and he's starts torturing him, and the whole ear scene, the camera specifically pans away and then comes back after he's already finished.
Yeah.
You know?
And then he talks into the ears like, "Hey, what's going on? Can you hear that?" That's like, you're watching this horrible thing and then you find yourself laughing. And that's the thing. Like, his movies are horrible. Like, horrible stuff happens, but it's like, you almost start to get numb to it.
Yeah.
You know, I was a kid watching these things. They were terribly violent and terrible, and I'm laughing. You know, maybe it's not a good thing. You know, maybe his movies are why I could probably see something really violent and be like,
It was the 90s. We're all doing it back then.
Everybody's doing it. Yeah.
What I'm about is playing the audience. Like, I feel like I'm the orchestra conductor, and the audience's reaction are my orchestra. And you're the sounds you make are my instruments, and your feelings are my instruments. And so it's like, I wanna, so it's like, laugh, 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 stop laughing. Stop laughing, okay, now be horrified. Be horrified, this is horrible, this is horrible, this is horrible, 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 laugh. And that's what I wanna do. That's what I get off doing. And to me, when someone does that to me, I've had a good time at the movies.
But this, the Reservoir Dogs, that was, you know, the whole, let's show kind of like the ending first and then see how we got there, type vibe. I don't know if he was the first person to do that or not, but that was definitely,
I think he definitely pioneered the non-linear storytelling and taking it into the mainstream.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure there's other people who have been doing that. He's very derivative. He'll be the first to tell you he's very influenced by tons of other people. So yeah, I'm sure, you know, the idea that he saw someone else tell a story out of order and he decided to do it himself isn't too out there. But definitely when most people do it nowadays, they're kind of copying him.
Yeah, I would think so. But yeah, that's kind of, even if he's, you know, got that off of someone else, you could say that was innovative to do it the way he did it, you know. It made it its own style, pretty much.
Yeah, it's his first movie out the gate, and he decides to like break every conventional rule of storytelling and movie making. Yeah, again, balls in this fucking kid, man.
And again, that opening scene. Yeah. Oh, that opening scene in the diner literally had nothing to do with the movie. It was just them all sitting around the table, talking about
Madonna,
like a virgin, right? What that video was about,
you know, and
what
tipping.
Oh yeah, tip. Oh god, the tipping versus no tipping. Oh geez.
If I've tried to weasel out of giving a tip by quoting that scene once, I've probably done it a million times. Half because I just like to act out that scene. Steve Buscemi's great. Half because I'm just cheap.
Well, it's good of you to admit that. On
No. I only do that when the waitress is bad. If a waitress, okay, I will tip. But I do kind of find something intrisically, you know, that's tipping automatically is for the birds. I kind of agree with that. You know what? It's
It's an asshole thing to say, but it's kind of everybody thinks it, I think.
Yeah. There's times where I'm really wishing like I didn't have to leave a tip, and I kind of grudgingly like fucking, you know, that's when I leave like 50% on the maybe I have done that once in my life, like to the penny. Like I am giving you the bare minimum. You know, what if you show up with just 13 pieces of flair? What do you think of someone who just does bare minimum? But yeah, that's a great speech, and we get all the characters in the movie introduced. Quentin making his acting debut as Mr. Brown, and then Michael Madsen.
I was gonna say, can you go off the colors?
Colors? Names: Mr. Brown, Mr. White, Mr. Blonde, Mr. Blue, Mr. Orange, Mr. Pink.
What I got, Mr. Pink?
Because you're a faggot, all right?
But, dude, Steve Buscemi in that scene, too. Good lord.
How about if I'm Mr. Purple? I was like, that's cool, because I like the color purple. I'd be Mr. Purple, too.
You're not Mr. Purple, you're Mr. Pink.
You're Mr. Pink.
There's another Mr. Purple on another job. You're Mr. Pink on this job.
That line, really shortly, but that little scene was in the trailer of him saying, like, who cares what your name is? Yeah, it's easy for you to say, you're Mr. White. You have a cool-sounding name. But Michael Madsen, though, man, he was cooler than cool. Vic Vega, the only guy who can make a bolo tie look cool.
Right.
But he looks cool in a fucking bolo tie, man. Michael Madsen was he was cool as shit in this movie. This was also my first real introduction to Harvey Keitel. He's an actor I knew about. I've heard his name. I knew he was like an actor my dad liked or something. He was up there with like those, like Lee Marvin or something, like those. Steve McQueen, like those actors I knew of, but he was out of my age range or something.
No, that's fair. Yeah. I'm the same way. Yeah. Yes. Tarantino definitely, he picks actors that he wants to work with and he sticks with them. Mm-hmm. And yeah, Harvey Keitel, damn. Was he the one that said, you shoot me in a dream, you better wake up and apologize?
You better wake up and apologize. Yeah.
God, what a great line. In his delivery on some of his lines, both this movie and Pulp Fiction, man, he's so great in both these movies.
Yeah, the way he taught me that you can light a Zippo lighter by snapping your fingers and lighting it like that, even though it took him like 5 tries in the movie to do it, which made me feel good about myself because I could almost never get it on the first try when I tried to light my Zippo with the snapping.
Hey, is that a signature of Tarantino, doing a Zippo lighter? Because like the first 3 movies, when I was going back and watching them, all of them have a shot of a Zippo lighter getting lit.
I've never heard that. He has many trademarks.
He does have, he has several, but I've noticed
that among them.
It was in, there's one in Pulp Fiction, Reservoir Dogs, and I want to say there's another movie that I saw that he did, there is a Zippo lighter being lit on screen.
If you're going to put a lighter on screen, you might as well make it a Zippo because it just looks cooler.
Oh yeah, obviously. No, I'm just saying the shot of that happening.
I don't
know.
I've never really thought about that. Maybe. But you know what's weird? Listeners, if you know what this is about, Harvey Keitel, like, he lights a Zippo, he lights Steve Buscemi's cigarette. And then he holds the lighter like an inch away from his cigarette, closes it, and then starts acting like he takes a cigarette out of his mouth, puts it in his fingers. He's talking like the cigarette is lit, but it wasn't. I don't know what that was about. Like, were they rehearsing? And then they're like, that was such a good take, we're going to use it. But I didn't light my cigarette. Fuck it. Moving on. I don't know. That always bugs me when I watch Harvey Keitel hold the lighter an inch away from a cigarette, close it, and start acting like it's lit.
Yeah.
if there's one bad thing to say about this movie, it's that little thing. But yeah, Quentin's great about dialogue, and this is a very dialogue heavy movie because it was so low budget, he couldn't do the action.
Yeah.
So he has to talk about the scene. So he has to write scenes where they explain how the thing, how the robbery went bad, and he has to talk about all the stuff he can't afford to film. But it works with him because he writes such great snappy dialogue. You know,
four rooms is the other one that had a Zippo lighter in it. I just did some quick research on that.
Oh yeah, duh. That was like the whole plot of Four Rooms.
Yeah. But anyway, there's three movies back.
But hey, I mean, I'm not a frog, and you're not a bunny, so let's not jump ahead.
Yeah.
And I've said that before, but that's a line from Four Rooms, so I can use it at this moment. One last thought about Reservoir Dogs, which, if you don't know what it's about, it's a bunch of thieves trying to rob. It goes bad.
It's a heist gone wrong.
Yeah, heist gone wrong. Shenanigans ensue. One thing I was noticing about Reservoir Dogs, and he does this a lot in his other movies, but this one just felt the most uncomfortable, was he, for the purpose of this conversation, forgive me, but he says the word nigger a lot. Not, I mean, like, well, yeah, Samuel L. Jackson get away with it. Let's go, dude. Come on. You know, I'm washing the windows and you picking up this nigga skull. If he's talking to another black guy, you know, it's that whole, you know, we're reclaiming it thing. And I got no problem. But the thing is, Quentin doesn't say nigga from a black character. He has white characters say nigger.
Yeah.
You know, you ever work with a bunch of niggas? Oh my God, you go into jail, a white man come out talking like a fucking nigger. You know, they say it in the bad way. bad way.
As opposed to the good way, right? What?
Yeah. You know, even in True Romance, like you said, we're talking about Drexel. He's like Clarence Worley. Almost sounds like a nigga name. He's not afraid to use it in the bad way.
I'm feeling uncomfortable just having this conversation right now.
Yeah. I'm sorry. You know, that's why I said earlier, like, I sometimes think he fancies himself. The thing is, though, I don't think he's nobody could accuse him of being racist, though.
Oh, hell no. No.
Like, at the time, it was his first movie, and you're like, whoa, you know, watch out with that word. Now, you know, after movies like Jackie Brown and Django, we're like, of course he's not racist. He puts Sam Jackson in everything. Sam Jackson will tell you he's not racist.
You're a smart motherfucker. That's right.
You sort of cut him a pass now, but back in the day, it was a little like, ooh, this is a little, even in Pulp Fiction, you know, Eric Stoltz tells him, like, you know, am I a nigger? Are we in Inglewood? No, you're in my home. White people who know the difference between good shit and bad shit, this is how they come to. Even he's being racist using the bad word.
Yeah.
And I don't want to say the N-word.
And folks, listeners, he's just quoting lines. He's not actually saying anything. So,
You know what? If Louis C.K. taught me anything, is the N-word is just white people getting away with saying nigger. That's hiding behind the first letter of a word. You know, because when you say, Louis C.K. says this, I'm not this clever. He's like, when you say the N-word, that's putting the thought in my head. Now you're making me think of the word nigger. Don't hide behind the N-word like a faggot. and I was like, Louis C.K. is brilliant. He's right, man. So I'm not going to hide behind the N-word. And again, like you said, I'm just quoting. So please don't hate me.
Shit, Negro. That's all you had to say.
But yeah, that was one thing that that in Reservoir Dogs, when I was rewatching it, left a little. Again, in hindsight, you cut him a pass, but that for his first movie, straight out the gate, to have a few scenes about that, how black women, that whole scene about the black woman who taped her boyfriend's dick to his belly.
With
wacko glue. Because I guess you couldn't say crazy glue. Quentin hates, one thing I like about him, he's like the opposite of Michael Bay. He hates product placement. That's why he comes up with red apple cigarettes and big Kahuna burgers and stuff. And he comes up with his own products, which is cool, I guess.
You got to respect that.
Got to respect it. Yeah, props.
I haven't done that much product placement in my movies because for the most part, I've actually been usually refused. If I want to use, I think all my first scripts always had some scene that took place at a Denny's because I had many scenes in my early 20s that took place at a Denny's.
And I was, you know, Reservoir Dogs in the original script, the opening scene where they're all talking at a Denny's, all right? The opening scene in Pulp Fiction, Pumpkin and Honey Buddy, at a Denny's.
Yeah.
In both cases, Denny's goes, no. Truthfully, I don't ever notice it unless it's super obvious.
Yeah.
And then when it's super obvious, it becomes ridiculously obvious. And then it can break the reality.
Let's see. Oh, one other thing about Reservoir Dogs. Yes. Tim Roth. That was this is the first time I've seen Tim Roth in anything. And something about him. He's got a presence to him. The way he's... I don't know. It's just...
Yeah, I saw this after Pulp Fiction, but had I seen this first, I don't think I would have known he was British. And he's got... He's probably like some of the characters get like a quick one or two, three, 5 minute tops backstory. Harvey Keitel and Vic, they get like a quick little backstory to explain their character. He gets like a really long backstory. It's almost like the third act of the movie. and it's really great. And you can start to see hints that Quentin's really nerdy. He has that speech about Fantastic Four.
We mentioned that on our Kevin Smith episode about how Mallrats was the first, or just Kevin Smith in general is kind of, he was using like comic book references in his movies, but 1992 for Reservoir Dogs. Quentin had a beat here.
He's like, remember the Fantastic Four? Oh, with that invisible bitch and Flame On and shit, right?
Yeah.
Great debut for a director, man. Your first movie out the gate, and you're like, wow, man, this kid, he's got a unique voice that's uniquely his own.
Mm-hmm.
Woof. We're really anticipating your next movie.
And he was the first. He used Hook on a Feeling first before Guardians of the Galaxy.
We talked about this one time. Yeah, you were saying how that movie kind of owns that song, and I was like, well, I'd probably say Alec McBeal does with that dancing baby. But beyond that, yes, totally, totally that scene. Give me the bear claw. Hooga chaka, yeah. So, like I was saying, his second outing as a writer director. Pulp Fiction, man.
Oh, oof.
Now this is a perfect movie to me, man. This movie blew my mind when I was a kid. I saw this in the theater 8 times. I would ride my bike to the movies, to Hollywood.
Yeah.
I'd ride my bike down there and I would buy a ticket for the Santa Claus and sneak into Pulp Fiction. And I don't even know why. I just saw the trailers on TV, the commercials. And I was like, what is this movie? It just intrigued me. It looked so interesting. And, you know, I biked to the movie. I saw it. And I was like, what the fuck was that? That was brilliant. And because it was so out of order and it was so unlike... this was the first Quentin Tarantino movie I'd ever saw.
Okay, yeah.
So, like, you can't fully absorb one of his movies in one sitting, you know?
Oh, yeah.
So I went back again, and then I went with like my mom and my brother, and I went with friends, and I went with other people, and I would occasionally sneak another in by myself. I just kept going back. I couldn't get enough. This movie was crazy, insane. I love it.
What else can we say? Next, not just kidding.
No.
Man, just everything from the visuals to the soundtrack. Oh, the soundtrack. Oof.
Probably best soundtrack of the 90s.
Yeah.
Or one of them.
The opening. Just the opening.
That Dick Dale Miserloo. That. Everybody knows that riff. That song is forever associated. Every song he uses becomes forever associated with... There was a soundtrack album. It was basically just a compilation of songs from all of his movies up until, like, you know, probably Pulp Fiction or whatever. Came out in the 90s. And there's a few tracks of him in between talking about how he chooses. That's another thing. Not a lot of directors that I know of where he will literally handpick songs to use in that scene.
Yeah.
There's probably a lot of them, but he picks obscure ones and he really thinks about it. And he writes it in the script. This song goes here. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm,
and it really complements the story, and his songs work in a really cool, neat, visceral way that's just special. it's just really special. And the effect is when you do it right and you get it right, the effect is you can never really hear that song again without thinking about that scene. He said one time. And the, yeah.
Oh, I thought he just walked in.
Shut up.
Oh, yeah.
Shut up. But totally, dude, every song that he uses in a movie, I can't hear that song again without if you hear Stuck in the Middle with You, which is a song I had loved my whole life. I've always liked that song.
Mm-hmm.
The ear cutting song. I'm never going to hear that song again without imagining a guy getting his ear hacked off, you know?
One should when you listen to music, yeah.
But totally, like, how many directors can really say that they can use a song that well? You know?
Yeah, and I think that's another trademark
signature. Maybe Wes Anderson. Wes Anderson.
Yeah, fuck him. That.
No, don't fuck him. Whatever. eight fucking times, man. That's funny. You said Patricia Arquette was in True Romance. This movie also has in Small Roles, Rosanna Arquette and Alexis Arquette. Mm-hmm. So he's had three of those siblings in his movies. But John Travolta, he had written this role and he wanted Michael Madsen to do it, but he was unavailable.
Oh, okay.
So he didn't really so much, like, John Travolta didn't get the role just like by default. Quentin is a huge John Travolta fan. And he really did want him for this role. And it's because of Quentin Tarantino that kids today know who John Travolta is.
Oh, definitely. I definitely think this is something that just helped his career last that much longer.
Well, I mean, it's still going on. What was the last movie he was in? I can't even think of it off the top of my head. We talked about John Travolta in an older episode.
Yeah.
So we're going to focus on him. But we also said in that old episode, he gave Bruce Willis a bit of a boost.
Definitely.
He was making like Color of Night and Striking Distance and, you know, some shit.
You figured this out all by yourself?
And then after this, he got like...
But he was the bomb in Hudson Hawk, though.
He was the bomb in Hudson Hawk. And you know what? I'm sure Sam Jackson would have had a great career regardless. Quentin just made it happen a little sooner.
Oh, and over and over and over again.
Yeah. and then this also introduced me to Uma Thurman.
Yeah.
I don't know what she had done before this, but she had to have done something. But she was great in this. Again, this is like what I said about True Romance, man. Just firing on all cylinders. Great movie. Brings Tim Roth back and Amanda Plummer in that great opening scene. I quote this movie all the time. When Vincent Vega just says, when he's at her apartment, he just goes, "I'm going to take a piss." She's like, "That's a little more information than I needed, Vince, but go ahead." That's how I tell people I'm going to take a piss. And then when he's in the diner talking to Jules, he just goes, "I'm going to take a shit." To be continued. That's also how I tell people I'm going to take a shit. Like, you could, both of them. He taught me how to say how to take a shit and how to take a piss. Okay, let me ask you this.
The influence never stops with this movie.
No, the influence never stops on Selena Kyle's answer machine. Let me ask you this. Of the three stories, because this one's very fragmented. What is your favorite of the three stories?
Just that first one with Vince and Jules going in and getting the briefcase.
The one with Uma Thurman and him and Uma Thurman at the Jackrabbit Slams and all that kind of stuff. Well, I mean, that's
say fragmented, I'm thinking that's that.
But I mean, there's title cards. There's like the gold watch, the Bonnie situation. You know, there's real title cards to these.
But yeah, just the stuff with Vince, the whole thing. I thought his character was so good in this movie.
Vince is
I think
because
it starts off so well, just with him and Jules just kind of talking, you know, and just going from the car all the way up there and taking care of everything. And
but him and Jules are also in that third segment very heavily with Harvey Keitel. Mm-hmm. And Quentin Tarantino, again, putting himself in a role. This is probably my favorite of his acting.
Who? What do you mean?
Quentin's.
Oh, yes. Jimmy.
Yeah, you know, every time I get my coffee, it's okay. I'm the one that buys it and how good it is.
God damn it.
You know, I buy the gourmet expensive because when I drink it, I want to taste it. Again, but you know what's on my mind right now? It ain't the coffee in my kitchen. It's the dead nigger in my garage. Again, with the bad way of saying it, you know? did you notice a sign at the front of my house that said dead nigger storage? It's so funny and so good, but it's the bad way.
It's so good, but yet so offensive.
Yeah, did you notice the sign in the front of my house that said dead nigger storage? No, we didn't. You know why? Why? Because it ain't there, because storing dead niggers ain't my fucking business. That's why. But it's so good, but it's bad.
Was that... You know what? When you need to set it like that, was when he's talking to Jules like that in that part, in that scene, is that kind of like karma or comeuppance to when Jules is talking to it's not Brett in the apartment? Do
Frank,
I look
Frank
like
Frank Whaley?
How does Marcellus look?
Yeah,
like?
That's Brett. Check out the big braid on Brett. Yeah, yeah. Does he look is like that, a bitch?
Yeah, is that, you know, because Quentin as Jimmy, he's kind of talking down to him, you know, do I have that sign in the front yard or, you know,
what sign?
As opposed, yeah, that sign, as opposed to
the dead nigger storage,
as opposed to the, does he look like a bitch?
I guess so. I mean, yeah, he kind of has the upper hand in that conversation. And then an hour later, Jimmy has the upper hand on him.
Yeah.
But he, yeah, he, you know, Jules in that movie says, nigga, you know, what the fuck, nigga, what the fuck you do to his towel? You know, he just says it all the time. And coming from Sam Jackson, it sounds fine. You don't bat an eye hearing him say it.
Yeah.
But, we're gonna talk about the whole nigger thing a little bit later too. But, yeah, this movie has a little bit to, again, it didn't so much bug me as a kid. Because I was just, it was so much going on. I was taking so much in. I mean, now I've seen a movie a million trillion fucking times. Again, the little things in the background start to notice them too. The little jokes, even stuff that isn't on the page it's not a joke. But like, when, you know, he does a whole speech about how good his coffee is. And then Harvey Keitel, the wolf, shows up and he's like, maybe a cup of coffee. And he has a cup and he turns and he looks at Jules and Vincent. He takes a sip and he turns back to Quentin and just goes, And I remember everybody in the theater laughing because it was just like the fact that they acknowledge he makes good coffee. There's not even really a joke in there, but it landed and it played. And I remember laughing. I remember other people laughing. I still laugh when I see it, when he just goes, like, that's good coffee. I don't know why that works, but it does. It's just, it's good writing, man. And there's, you know, there's little things that you don't notice right away, but after, you know, more viewings, you start to notice, like Bruce Willis and his story, his girlfriend, Fabian, mm-hmm. Was she pregnant?
I didn't get that, if she is.
Well, she has that whole speech, like, I wish I had a pot belly. Pot mm-hmm. bellies are sexy. And then she's like, the next day, she talks about wanting to order that huge breakfast with the blueberry pie and all that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And even after they shower, Butch goes to lie down and she walks in the room and she goes, Butch, he's asleep. She just goes, never mind. Like, she had something to tell him, you know, and just all these things added up. You're like, you know, is she trying to tell him she's pregnant? Again, this is kind of a fan theory, something again, I'm proud to say I came to on my own, but, you know, that, but after like constant viewings, you start putting all these little bitty details together, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Well,
but yeah, Butch has seen the whole ass rape scene. That was hard to watch, like, with my mom. When I was, I was a kid and your mom was taking the movies. Like, I saw this really cool movie. Oh, let's go see it. It was like, it's hard to watch Ving Rhames get ass raped with your mom.
Yeah, wouldn't.
I wouldn't recommend it, but yeah.
You okay? Nah, man. I'm pretty fucking far from okay.
I mean, God, yeah, we can keep going on this movie.
But there's so many memorable moments and scenes in this movie. The Amsterdam talk, Royale with cheese, stuff like that.
The metric system, you know, Fox Force 5. Just fucking, you name it, man. I could act this whole movie out for you.
The fact that they explain what a TV pilot is.
the way they make TV shows, they make one show. That show's called a pilot. And then they show that show to the people who pick shows. And on the strength of that show, they decide they want to make more shows. It works. This is a very, yeah, I had this movie down pat. If I want to, one time, when I was in my squadron, I was working on the top level in logs and records, like an office. And a good friend of mine was a yeoman, and I would do scenes from all the time. We'd be hanging out, drink, whatever. And he was in the back where all the officers and chiefs were hanging. And all of a sudden I just hear like my last name get yelled out front and center. Okay. I go in there. Like, what the hell's going on? Thinking I'm in trouble. I'm like, yes, senior. He goes, I hear you could do that scene in Pulp Fiction about the the mushroom cloud motherfucker. The scene where they're cleaning the brain, you know. Well, I'm a mushroom cloud land motherfucker. That whole bit. My buddy used to love it when I did that scene, and then I get called in front of all these officers and chiefs, and he's like, do the scene. I'm like, okay. So I did it, and it got a laugh, and it was a little awkward, cursing officers and shit, whatever. But yeah, I used to love to quote this movie all the time because it's such great dialogue. Who wouldn't want to? God, another buddy, my friend Eddie, loves it. He loves to get me drunk and make me do the gold watch scene. The whole monologue, dude. You know, this watch. Oh, man. Great scene. Arguably one of the best monologues, like, ever. Again, Chris Walken gets to say these great Quentin lines from True Romance. He gets to do it here again.
Right? Yeah.
You know, this is,
and maybe that's why he's able to get these great actors to come back after.
Why wouldn't you want to do this stuff? Yeah,
exactly. Yeah,
you know, 5 long years I wore this watch up his ass till he died of dysentery. He gave me the watch. That's not the only time he gets a little Chris Walken in that speech. Is when he gave me the watch, but it's the gold watch scene is brilliant. Oh God, love this movie. Love this movie. I want to slap my knee. Talk about how great this movie is.
All right. Let me ask you something. Because you said you've seen it a million trillion times and you million start picking up on times. Different things. Has there ever been any revelation or fan theories or anything about what was in the briefcase?
There's tons of theories, but Quentin has gone on record as not saying. He will not say. So, and he likes that fans have come up with their own theories. There's been a lot of theories. I suspect it was a light bulb.
A light bulb?
Yes. That's my theory. I think it was a light bulb in there.
But it was lit up on gold and shit whenever they opened it up.
Yeah, a light bulb. one theory that I remember reading a long time ago that I thought was cool was that it is Marcellus Wallace's soul. And that is why when we first meet, quote unquote, meet Ving Rhames, is we just meet the back of his head. But he's got that Band-Aid on the back of his head.
Yeah.
Which there's nothing to that. He just had a cut. Quentin thought it looked cool. But maybe like somehow they extracted his soul and put it in a briefcase. And that's so he sent these two hitmen to go retrieve his soul. You got to pay the troll toll if you want to get the boy's hole. It's boy's soul, but that's one of the big theories that I think sounds cool. I mean, I don't know how you keep a soul in a briefcase or something, whatever. It's a neat idea. And then Vincent has the combination is 666 to unlock the briefcase.
Okay.
I don't know if that was that Marcellus is the devil. Marcellus Wallace is the devil. I don't know. Quentin has said, I'm not going to tell you. Just come up with your own theories. And so I've never really paid too much attention to what other people think they are. But the one about Marcellus's soul always stuck with me.
Okay. Well, you answered another question that I had for you. What was the deal with the Band-Aid on his neck?
Ving Rhames cut his neck.
Yeah, I actually had that written down. That was the one thing. Did I miss something in anything? I guess not.
After Pulp Fiction, at some point he sold another script, Natural Born Killers, which Oliver Stone ended up directing, and he changed a lot of it. Quentin's even said, this is not like my original script. You could tell it's been monkeyed with. And I don't want to dwell too much on that because this is a Quentin spotlight. He gets story credit on that film, but Oliver Stone and two other writers get screenplay credit. And when you think of that movie, it's the visuals that stand out for me, the directing. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Not that there isn't good dialogue in it. And there's hints here that you could tell, like, that's a Quentin line or that's a Quentin name.
Mm-hmm.
Like Tom Sizemore's character, who is also in True Romance, is named Jack Scagnetti. And then in True Romance, Vic Vega's parole officer is Seymour Scagnetti. Little things like that that kind of, you know, bounce together. Natural Born Killers is a great movie. I think acting wise, all Robert Downey Jr. and Woody Harrelson, everybody in that movie is great. Tommy Lee Jones is hilarious. It's a great movie. I'd love to read Quentin's actual script.
Oh yeah.
Cause I can't imagine that's, you know, that, I mean, that's obviously not how we wrote it, but, it was a good movie.
Jesus, Harold Christ on a fucking rubber crutch, is this happening to me?
I saw that in the theater with my dad. I remember this is like, I think I had just moved and I was hanging out with my dad a whole lot and we were going to the movies a lot. And we would just go, we'd just show up. There was no Fandango apps on our mm-hmm. phones that we didn't have.
You actually had to look it up in the newspaper, folks. Yeah,
or call movie phone. If you know the name of the movie you'd like to see, press one. Yeah, I got so good at that, man. Like, I knew exactly what he was going to say. It was like, if you know the doot-doot-doot, you have to like doot-doot-doot, which theater doot. Like, I had it down cold. Anyways, so me and my dad walk up to the box office. I don't even know what we're going to see. And he's like, 2 for Natural Born Killers. I kind of look up at him like, what? Really? Seriously? And he just shrugs. He's like, you're going to see it anyway. Might as well see it with me. And I was like, can't argue with that. let's see this fucking movie. Let's build that reactor. So, it blew my mind, man. My mom was so upset when she found out my dad did that. But whatever. But, I mean, you've seen Natural Born Killers, of course, right?
Yeah, it's been several years, but yeah.
Okay, you haven't seen it in a long time?
I'm not, yeah, I didn't get a chance to go back and watch it.
Do you remember liking it?
I'm trying to think, man. I remember thinking this is kind of out there for that movie, but
it's a little out there, yeah.
Yeah, I need to definitely revisit that movie.
Yeah. Well then right after that one, he met as we talked about this, Robert Rodriguez and him are good friends, are good buddies, and I think it was on the Telluride Film Festival. He was promoting Dogs, Robert was promoting Mariachi, and they met and they hooked up and they became friends and they decided to want to work together. So they collaborated on a little film called Four Rooms. Okay. It's a one movie with four interconnecting stories with four different writer directors, Allison Anders, Alexander Ruckwell, Robert Rodriguez, and Quentin Tarantino.
Mm-hmm.
And Quentin Tarantino's was, I think the name was called The Man from Hollywood, was the name of his.
Yeah, segment. He did the final, it was the final little short film in the movie.
Yeah. And him, Bruce Willis, Paul Calderon, Jennifer Beals, and of course Tim Roth, who is the link between all four movies. What'd you think about this? Do you like this movie or at least his segment or the movie?
I like the movie just in general. Tim Roth in this movie, I don't know if you want to call it hamming it up or just something, I don't know, but but man, some of his delivery and lines, oh good Lord.
Hello, Betty. What's the problem? I haven't got a problem. I've got fucking problems. Plural. Wanna hear?
But yeah, The Man from Hollywood, again, going back to the dialogue of, this is the first movie that I found out what Cristal was. Fucking Cristal.
It's fucking Cristal. Everything else is piss.
Piss.
So, Ted, what do you think about that tasty beverage? He likes to say tasty beverage a lot, too. Do you mind if I have some of your tasty beverage to wash this down? Even in Death Proof, he's like, is that a tasty beverage or is that a tasty beverage? So he said tasty beverage in his scripts 4 times. And again, this is something that you just like Tarantino fans start to notice over and over. Mm-hmm. Names that are similar, you know.
You start looking for these trademarks.
Yeah, there's a scene in True Romance. Well, it's a deleted scene to Romance, but it's in Buscemi says in Reservoir Dogs, like, someone's sticking a hot poker up her ass. I want to find out whose name is on the handle. Chris Walken says that in a deleted scene in True Romance. In Reservoir Dogs, Tim Roth's, like, cop handler, the black guy, says, like, I bet you anything from a little lad Joe to damned if I know. And then in True Romance, Drexel says, have yourself an egg roll. We got everything here from little lad Joe to damned if I know. Like, there's no coincidence that expression, which I've never heard in my life or heard since, is in both of these movies. He's not against, cannibalizing a line here and there. And, you know, fuck it. It sounds cool.
And it's his stuff. So
it is his stuff. Yeah. Fuck it. Don't tell him he can't rip his own shit. Don't tell him how to do his. Don't tell him anything, man. He's got it down. He picks the soundtracks. He directs it. He writes it. He'll act in it. If he's feeling. And maybe somebody should tell him to rein it in there, here and there. I don't know, man. His acting in The Man from Hollywood and Four Rooms. It's Quentin.
He's playing Quentin.
He's basically being Quentin. Yeah. And Quentin is it's a great. It's a short segment. I don't even know how long it is. I haven't seen it in years.
It's probably not even 20 minutes. It's basically just a scene of him saying what they're going to do, pretty much.
Him,
that's it.
Tarantino, Bruce Willis, and Paul Calderon, who was also in Pulp Fiction, who was up for the role of Jules until Sam agreed to do it. It's New Year's Eve. They're drunk. They're partying. And then they're talking about, is it not a Twilight Zone, a Hitchcock episode, I think.
Yeah,
it's called Man from Rio. You ever see any of those old Hitchcock episodes? Yes, sir. You ever see the one called Man from Rio with Peter Lorre and Steve McQueen? If you did, you know it. It's called Man from Rio with Peter Lorre and Steve McQueen. And yeah, he bets that he can light a cigarette lighter 10 times in a row. And if he can, he wins his car. If he can't, he cuts off his finger. And they show a picture of Quentin standing in front of this racked up nigger red Chevy Chevelle. which is actually Quentin's car. It's the car John Travolta drove in Pulp Fiction, and it's the first thing he bought with the money he got from selling True Romance. Fun fact, or probably not very fun at all, but too bad. You heard it. So they want
doesn't
Ted,
like trivia.
Yeah, so they want Ted to wield the hatchet. I won't spoil it, but yeah, it all takes place in a hotel room. It's Quentin having fun with some friends. This is a fun little
I love Bruce Willis in the background, just the conversation he's having.
What the fuck is wrong with this bitch? Fuck yeah. Again, he's using it in the bad way. I treat this fucking bitch like a queen. It's fucking New Year's Eve. I've had too much to drink. One was supposed to drive home, crashed into a bus, killed several, whatever. Yeah, he's drunk, he's funny. I guess he had just done Pulp Fiction, so he's like, yeah, fuck it, I'll do another movie with you. Fucking resurrected my career. I still say that the misbehaviors of Robert Rodriguez's segment right before it is my favorite one, but obviously Quentin's is a close second. Easily. Their two segments are high above Allison Anders and Alexander Rockwell's. Although I guess Alexander Rockwell's is the third best. It's like the movie, yeah. And then the one with the witches, the Covet of Witches, is probably like my least favorite. Not that it's bad.
Which is weird we say that. I mean, you know.
Yeah.
Bunch of hot naked chicks, you know.
Yeah, Ione Sky is in it. She gets naked. Yeah. She's so cute. And
it's weird that the misbehaviors is ranked high for you. The children in that. Did you like the kids?
They're great. I usually most kids I want to chuck them into a wood chipper, and they are like the focus of this bit, but they're both funny and they're really good, and Robert wrote good shit for them to say, and Tim Roth in particular, he's funny in the whole movie, but he's a little inconsistent because you've got four directors telling him how to do their thing, you know. And the first one, the one with the witches, he's weird when he's like squeaking his ears and he's just he's a little weird. And then in the third one, he's like a badass. Like, don't break the rules, and I won't break your necks. You know, stuff like that. And then in the Quentin one, he's a little aloof because he doesn't know what's going on, and so he's a little different in every sketch because you got different directors and stuff like that. But Tim Roth in Roberts is my favorite.
But this is not with the Quentin thing, but this scene where they show him the dead hooker.
And he just throws
what the fuck?
And it's like, while he's throwing up, he's saying, like, what the fuck is that? Like, while puke is flying out of his mouth. So funny. And we're talking about Quentin cannibalizing his own shit. Robert does the bit where he's like, where probably my favorite bit in the whole movie is where he's combing his son's hair back and it's almost pulling his hair. He's like, ah. He's like, duh, you see? You look cool with your hair back like this, like me. Not down and to the side, all stupid, the way your mother likes to comment. Because he does the exact same thing as Spy Kids 2, like almost with Antonio. He does the same thing, but he's like, anybody who watches Spy Kids probably didn't see Four Rooms, so fuck it.
I haven't seen any of the Spy Kids movies, so.
Really? They're not bad.
I'll take word for it.
They're not great, But they're not. The first two aren't bad. Third one's bad. And the fourth one's kind of bad. Anyways, so after. So, Ted, what do you think about that tasty beverage? So after that, okay, he hooks up with Robert again.
Mm-hmm.
He writes the screenplay while Robert directs for a movie called From Dusk Till Dawn.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir.
Mm. Love that movie. Quentin doesn't get story credit. Story credits by some other bloke who's Kurtzman or something like that. Like Robert Kurtzman, I think, gets story credit. Quentin gets screenplay. So he didn't conceive this idea. So I don't know. I mean, because he pretty much does his own thing, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I guess
I always equate this one as just like more or less just not just, but you know, more or less an actor in this movie than the creation of the movie. But I could be totally wrong on that. I know he had, like you're saying, he did some stuff with it, but
what'd you think of his acting?
Like you're saying, he only gets
this is probably his biggest acted role. As Richie Gecko.
He plays a good weird dude.
Oh, yeah, I guess. I don't think he can play anything but weird dude. Kind of weird. I think, he plays George Clooney's brother. Come on, dude. He even, like, tries to comb his hair like George Clooney. And, like, dude, you're not George Clooney. you know, he has good lines. Of course he does, because he's, you know, he writes good shit. But
mm-hmm.
I don't know, man. It seemed like... If he wasn't the guy writing it, and if he wasn't friends with the director, there's no way you would have cast him in that role.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Now, if you give him little roles like Mr. Brown or Jimmy, that's okay. But this is like a hefty role. It's almost like half the movie.
Do you think he held his own? Or, I mean, where are you going with that?
Yeah, I mean, I think this guy wants to be an actor. He does. He's taken acting classes, and he's a brilliant writer. He's a brilliant director. I'll just say that. I don't know, man. They just seem tight. Plus, he does the same. He acts the same way in everything he does. He acts like Quentin Tarantino. And at this point,
is true.
At this point, I'm starting to see who Quentin Tarantino is, you know. And like, I'm only seeing that. So, I don't know. He's not bad.
There was an episode, what is it, either CSI or Criminal Minds, where there was a two-part episode,
CSI.
And he played was it CSI?
Yeah,
and he played the bad guy, criminal, or whatever in those two episodes, and he did actually a pretty decent job in those.
Yeah. He also had a little arc on Alias.
Yes.
It was like four episodes or something, but it was like, oh, Quentin Tarantino is a spy, or whatever is basically what I took from it. Because he's trying to act tough, but it's like, all you see is Quentin Tarantino acting like this, or Quentin Tarantino acting like that. That's all I see when I see him.
Fair enough.
I love the guy. I mean, I've been sucking his dick for the last hour. Of course, I love the guy, but... Stick behind the camera, buddy. Stick behind the typewriter. Or the paper and pen, or whatever. I hear your hands write scripts.
Why do you want to be an actor? Why do you want to act is a word, not a question. Why do you want to be an actor?
All right, why do I want to act? Well, it's what I started doing, all right? It's like, it was my first entry into show business was acting. The only formal study I've ever had in my entire life has been acting. I quit school in the ninth grade. I didn't go to high school. I didn't go to college. I didn't go to director school. I didn't go to writing school, whatever that would be. All right. I've studied acting and I've studied boxing, and those are the only forces, only sense of study I've ever had.
Yeah, Dusk Till Dawn was a great movie. I remember my jaw was on the ground the entire time Selma Hayek was dancing.
Yes.
And then you knew he's the writer because he writes a scene where she like sticks her foot in his mouth. Yeah. Okay. You know, we were talking earlier about trademarks and things like that. Yeah. Feet. Yeah, man. Guy loves feet. He's probably paid many a hooker to lube up and literally make love to the soles of their feet.
There's a scene in Kill Bill where she's like staring at her feet in the pussy wagon.
Wiggle your big toe.
Oh, God, her feet are so nasty.
their feet. I don't know.
Like the pigtail is like crooked. It's like there's like oh, it's like come on.
First of all, their feet. I don't know. I mean, like I don't like feet. Like I don't. I've never had a desire to like fuck feet.
No, I hate feet.
Okay, yeah. See, I don't hate feet. Although I do notice feet. Like oh, and hands too. I don't know. Mm-hmm. I just think it says something about a person, hands and feet. I don't know what it is, but like if a chick is wearing flip flops or something, I will notice the feet, but I'm not like, oh, feet. I'm not going to sniff their shoe or something. Like I used to be very self-conscious about my feet. I didn't own a pair of flip flops till I was like 23.
I'm the same way, dude. Yeah.
I got over that. Cause actually I think I actually have nice feet. I've been told, every time a girl tells me I have nice feet, I always reply with yeah, I work out. which I think Michael Keaton said in a movie. I never say anything original. But yeah, he loves feet. In Pulp Fiction, there's a shot. We're introduced to Uma Thurman's feet before we actually see her.
Yeah.
And then what did we just talk about? I'm trying to think if there's any feet in no feet in Four Rooms, no feet in, but we get a lot of feet in Dust Till Dawn, and we get more feet later. Death Proof should be called like Death Feet. It's like it's all about feet in that movie. But yeah,
Four Rooms would be by guilty by association because Misbehaviors, they take off their socks, the little kid's feet.
Yeah, I bet Quentin is like, hey, you know what would be funny if she holds her foot up? He's like my feet don't stink. Go ahead. And the little kid's like literally sucking on his own toe, which
yeah.
is funny.
Because
when you're a kid are you like that flexible and stuff, where you can like literally like bite your own toenails, which I did do when I was like 8 or something. Yeah, I would like bite my own toenails because I was flexible like that. I was a skinny kid. what the fuck are we talking about? You guys are making me lose my train of thought here. I was saying something. What was it?
Oh, I'm sorry. Did I break your concentration?
Dust Till Dawn. Harvey Keitel's back. Juliette Lewis, who was in Natural Born Killers. Even the movies that he writes, mm-hmm. it seems like there's a lot of connection. Like you know, like we said, Tom Sizemore was in Natural Born Killers and True Romance. You know, that he wrote both of them. And Juliette Lewis was in Natural Born Killers and From Dust Till Dawn. Two movies that he just wrote and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
It seems like even there's like weird connections actor-wise. But it's such a cool movie. It's like, it's almost like two movies.
Yeah.
You know, because it just,
pretty much.
Yeah. Again, I saw this one with my dad. And when all the vampires shows up, he's like, what the fuck is going on? He didn't know what he was getting into. He was just, I was like.
Dude, that twist in that movie. And I call that a twist because up until that point, you really didn't know. I mean, yeah, like you're saying, it starts off, you know, just a couple bandits doing a heist. And that's, you know, they're on the run pretty much. And then when you see the twist after the dance and everything by Sam Hayek, dude, the
pandemonium. Yeah, Sam Hayek, she's just like 5 feet of sexiness, especially in 1995.
Oh yeah, definitely.
Yeah, this movie also starts just heavy dialogue with the sheriff, Michael Parks. So again, who shows up later, just coming in and talking to the. To the guy about, you know, he just stands at the counter and like 5 minutes of dialogue between these two dudes, you know, before the movie like mm-hmm. kicks into gear, so to speak.
Yeah, yeah. But yeah, again, going back to what we were saying before, I don't think Quentin, I mean, I'm sure he had some input on the script story thing like that, but his as far as being credit for this movie, it's more or less just acting, more or less.
Acting. Sorry, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, he did write it. I wonder if he was like in Robert's ear the whole time. Like, you should do it this way. You know how you want to be cool? You want to be cool if you try to like.
Oh, sure, there's some collaboration. I'm sure about that. I wouldn't be surprised. I meant to ask something earlier because I know I saw it on Four Rooms, and I think it might have been before Four Rooms, but A Band Apart. Do you have any information or anything any trivial stuff that you could tell us about that?
To be honest, nothing I feel comfortable saying because I'm not like positive. I know that was like his production, like studio or whatever you call it.
Did he start that from the beginning? Like, does Reservoir Dogs and Reservoir Dogs does have that? Yeah,
but because it's like the Band Apart picture is like the Reservoir Dogs.
Is them? Yeah.
I don't know. I think he just kind of dropped it or he. I mean, I don't know. I just know you don't see that anymore.
Yeah,
is all so, like your Troublemaker Studios. I don't think I see that anymore. Same thing with Robert, the Band Apart, which was really quick. Sort of take an exit here for a second. I just want to talk really quick about a man named Roger Avery. We're kind of talking like it's all Quentin. I don't want to dwell on too much. I just want to acknowledge him. A guy named Roger Avery, he worked with Quentin at Video Archives, and he kind of collaborated with Quentin on his first few movies. In fact, him and Quentin both won the Oscar for Best Screenplay for Pulp Fiction. He has an Oscar for Best Screenplay for Pulp Fiction. There's no denying that he had something to do with it. At a certain point, they stopped working together. I think they had a falling out. They're both kind of hush about it. They're both kind of respectful. And I don't know what he contributed. In fact, very recently, I was listening to a podcast that had him on it. And the podcaster was trying to get like what specific lines in Pulp Fiction did you contribute? And he wanted like specifics. And Roger Avery was deflecting. He's like, well, you know, it's a huge collaboration and this and that. And he was, so I don't know exactly what it brings to it. We're talking like it's all Quentin. But I just want to give credit where credit is due. For the first few movies, even True Romance included, he had some input, things like that. In fact, I think he was the one with Quentin's blessing who was hired to restructure True Romance to be a linear story. Because Quentin was busy making Reservoir Dogs. He's like, I don't got time to work on True Romance, but my friend here will alter the script for you. Like uncredited work, but he was involved in Quentin's first few movies. So I just want to throw that out there. He went on to make, write and direct some movies of his own. Killing Zoe, kind of a cool French bank robber movie with Eric Stoltz. And he adapted Bret Easton Ellis's Rules of Attraction with James Vanderbeek. And then he wrote Beowulf, that Robert Zemeckis CGI movie.
Oh yeah, the CGI, yeah.
And then he went to jail. Like he was driving drunk and he like killed the person who was in the passenger seat with him, and he went to jail for like manslaughter. And ever since then, his career has kind of stalled. This happened like 08 or something. So he's not doing much. But neither of them will speak ill of the other. But they're very like, you know. Again, I don't want to speak heresy. I don't know what happened, but I just want to throw that out there that there was a dude who was involved in Quentin's first few movies. His name is Roger Avery. There you go. Just want to give some shout out to that dude.
All right, kids, that's going to be it for part one of our big Quentin Tarantino spotlight. We'll conclude this discussion with part two, which will be out very soon, if not by the time you're listening to this episode. Just go to popculturerewind.com, iTunes, or Stitcher, and please remember to leave a nice comment review for us. Until then, always remember to pop your culture.
Fuck. To be continued.